Art Museum by Marku Lindros. Standing in the shivering queue outside the art museum on a bitterly cold, frosty morning, it was a struggle to keep my toes from freezing in my fashionable shoes. It was a stroke of luck that there wasn't an exhibition by some major blockbuster artist right now, which would have had the line snaking down two blocks. My fashion-conscious young companion, in her skimpy vanity, was freezing even more than I was. I tried to keep her as close as possible to warm her slender body, and it was not at all unpleasant. I draped an arm around her shoulders, and she allowed it to happen, even though we shared no close acquaintance, nor had we ever met before. It might not have been entirely appropriate given our significant age gap, but it was truly freezing. The art student had been sent as my guide for semi-official reasons, because the museum was expecting an annual donation from my company. They wanted to ensure our satisfaction. She apparently didn't have her own pass, as we had to queue for the doors to open just like regular visitors. The doors opened on time, however, and it was our own fault for arriving too early. I reassured the anxious art student that I wouldn't complain about it. Once inside, we kept our overcoats on and headed straight to the newly opened cafe. Still shivering, we bought hot coffee and sat at a table, smiling stiffly at one another. In that shared freezing experience, there was something intensely personal that brought us closer, and something had shifted in our touch, as if we had mutually agreed to take things further. Yet we spoke of ourselves only in the superficial terms one uses with strangers during conference breaks. She was a second-year student at the Academy of Fine Arts at the University of the Arts, still unsure of her future plans beyond her master's degree. She occasionally did gig work as a museum guide, and well, here we were. I shared only vague details about my work at a large multinational IT corporation and mentioned that art was one of the sectors our company supported. We are also major buyers of contemporary art for our corporate premises worldwide. That side of things isn't strictly under my purview, but when it comes to funding, I hold local decision-making power. I occasionally visit exhibitions to learn, and now and then buy artwork for my home, without being a collector in the truest sense. We didn't speak of anything personal, though we appraised each other with contemplative glances, searching for what remained unsaid. I did mention, however, that I was divorced and that my two children lived in the U.S. under the custody of their American mother, and that we didn't see each other often enough. Once we warmed up, we left our coats at the cloakroom and climbed up a floor, beginning our tour in the main hall. I remarked that I was most drawn to a veiled woman sculpted in wood, even though the walls were lined with masterpieces by the country's most renowned artists, national art treasures I remembered from my early school days. I have visited many of Europe's grand art museums, but never this one, despite living in the city. I don't know why. Being busy is a poor excuse. I do receive invitations to various exhibitions and openings, but work leaves me no time. The company employs dedicated staff for these matters, and it was mere coincidence that due to an illness, I was asked if I wanted to make this scheduled visit. I wanted to signal to the girl beside me that I was no expert and that she should talk to me about art, as if to an ignorant child. She smiled with a subtle, personal intent, as if I were a teddy bear. Some young women are drawn to older men in that way. We strolled through the galleries, and the girl illuminated things with her insights on how to look at this piece or contemplate that one. I said I understood that motives in art are often tied to associations and symbolism, even when the works are realistically precise in their details. She nodded and said emphatically, "Why, you understand art like a true patron." "I don't know," I replied. "I suspect that in images, the viewer must somehow supplement the sense of sight with their own memories and perceptions. They have to search within themselves for thoughts that evoke a certain friction, cold or heat, anxiety or joy, intellect or emotion." The girl answered, "That is exactly how I think. An artist's duty is to awaken all of that in their work, no matter what style they represent." We had stopped in front of a painting of a woman bouncing a child on her knee. She guided me. "Mother and child is an archetypal motif, and I think the mother-child relationship comes through beautifully in this piece. It's painted with flawless technical mastery, and it's world famous for a reason." I agreed completely. The painting was truly magnificent, and I said with genuine admiration in my voice, "It is absolutely fantastic, brilliant. It makes me envious that my own relationship with my mother wasn't like that." Shared alignment brings people closer, and I began to see the girl as a young, desirable woman. I guessed her age to be somewhere in her early 20s. It wouldn't be improper if we were to dally, our minds deepened by art. She continued her lesson. Moments pass too quickly to be seen properly or to understand everything connected to them. Visual art is often the sum of many moments, and paintings frequently reveal the entire history that led to the scene, complete with all its contradictory motives and layers. Of course, it also reflects the artist's own views and opinions. We stopped before an Edvard Munch painting, rendered with an almost careless hand, depicting naked men on a beach. She stepped closer, examining its every detail. I blurted out, "Hardly anything happens in this painting. Their junk hangs dejectedly, as if depicting an old man's lost potency. The whole painting looks like a sketch." The woman replied, "Exactly. A nude in every sense of the word, wouldn't you say?" She then shared how Munch would place his massive canvases outside on his property and paint in the nude. Once finished, he would leave his works out for months at the mercy of the elements, to be faded by the sun, ravaged by wind and rain, to achieve a natural patina, as he called it. The impression mattered more to him than the precision of a brush stroke. In this picture, too, he portrays his own spiritual and physical nudity, and his weary, everyday melancholy, even though the sun shines in the background and the children play on the beach with joyful energy. She stood before the painting for a long time, studying its anatomy altogether too closely, making me feel somewhat ashamed because I could have been one of those male figures. Our next stop was a delicate self-portrait by Helene Schierfbeck, a borderline schizophrenic mental anguish in her eyes. I could see a flash of a personal emotional trauma, the kind that belongs to a woman's life, cross my guide's face. I said cautiously, "Artists often seem to have a single theme they can't escape, painting hundreds of variations on essentially the same subject. It's a bit like a writer who always writes the same book, no matter the plot, or a musician whose songs all sound identical." Helene Schierfbeck painted images of her inner states as if completely detached from her surroundings, and to me, there is something morbid about that. The woman beside me said ironically, "Oh, so you're the expert. I didn't know you knew more about Helene Schierfbeck than I do." "I don't," I said. "But I visited an exhibition about her in Stockholm, and on that basis, I fancy myself knowing more than I actually understand." She replied, "You do know, don't you, that Helene Schierfbeck is sacred to us women. A male chauvinist shouldn't interpret her on such flimsy grounds." "Well, I know now. I respect her as an artist, and I suppose a sort of turpentine-scented madness is just part of the artistic life, whether the artist is a man or a woman. Let's drop it. We came to look, not to debate." As we looked at the fighting capercaillies, I mentioned that in my grandparents' home, there had been a precise oil copy of the painting done by my grandmother's cousin, almost as fine as the original. She smiled a second time, a clear look of derision on her face. I paused to look at a nude portrait of a Bohemian woman on a sofa covered with an oriental patterned throw, a guitar by her side. My companion said nothing, though the image captured the Bohemian lifestyle of the 1920s and a snapshot of how the luminaries of that era amused themselves. I knew from the painting that it was an authentic depiction and that every vice-ridden, top-hatted gentleman of the time would have recognized both the place and the woman. I said, "To me, this is one of the best and most honest works in the museum. If I remember correctly, the room and the woman are entirely authentic, and a novella was even written about it." The woman sensed that I was leading her, manipulating the conversation, and she had no desire to discuss historical sexuality in front of the image. It wasn't my intention to seduce a woman so much younger than myself, but it was clear that the art was affecting us both in profound ways. Unintentionally, the signals between us telegraphed unspoken questions and answers, and there was nothing to be done about it. Having lost the previous argument, I said provocatively, "To me, it's a painting you could fall in love in front of. Sex and the complex instinctual emotions tied to it ooze from every single brushstroke. It isn't porn, it's life." We didn't look at each other, and blushing, the woman said, "At the very least, it reflects the male psyche and the oppressive hand of exploitation. I suppose it captures its era, and things haven't exactly improved since then. Every man is present in that picture, even if not a single one is visible." I wondered if a rift had formed between us, or a new bond. All young female intellectuals are automatically feminists, and it is a quality that both irritates and excites. Many young women are fashionably lesbian nowadays, even if they aren't truly so. We moved into another room, where a hideous, half-blind old crone from Pablo Picasso's Blue Period diffused the tension of the previous moment. By the time we reached the next abstract painting, we had returned to our formal distance, and she said as dryly as possible, "In art, abstraction is not an end in itself, but a means to express complex emotional states or convey thoughts about the world. It allows the viewer to interpret the content through their own associations, which isn't always possible with realistic, literal portraits." I guessed she was still processing what had just happened, and I joined the effort, injecting a feigned admiration into my voice. "You analyze these works with such depth. I'm grateful for the guidance. It forces one to notice the artist's intent." She looked at me, her mouth a tight line, anger in her eyes, and snapped, "Don't even try. I know exactly what you're thinking. I think it's better if you finish the tour alone. We were back on that volatile frequency, which was exactly what I wanted, and I said, "You're right, and I'm sorry, but one can't always help their thoughts. Go ahead, I'll just look through the International Hall and then head out. If anyone asks about the visit, you'll get top marks, and I support the intended donation with all my heart. Your company was exhilarating. It made me experience the art under my very skin." She gave an ironic smile and said, "So be it. Men will be men. What can you do?" Fragrant with the scent of lavender, she kissed me lightly on both cheeks and walked away. Next to the tall totem poles stood a young woman with a strangely cut hairstyle, wearing trousers with a pattern identical to the base of one of the totems. Sometimes coincidences are so bizarre that they defy explanation. I didn't expect much from the European art department, but I entered the gallery anyway because I had told the woman I would, and perhaps because she was spying on me to expose my uncultured nature. The selection exceeded my expectations, a comprehensive, world-class touring exhibition featuring major works or earlier versions of them by renowned artists from the turn of the last century. Van Gogh, Cézanne, early Picasso, Dalí, and Matisse. I thought of Picasso. The small can be a giant, a great deal can be shown with very little, and genius truly exists. Hurrah for that. The blind eye of La Célestine, the witch from Picasso's Blue Period, stared after me all the way to the exit. Outside the Ateneum, the biting wind stung my skin, and there at the tram stop stood the young woman, shivering. I wasn't sure if I should go over, even though I needed a ride myself. I said to myself, "The flesh asks, and the flesh answers." And so I went to join the queue, like any other man. I pretended not to notice her, though I knew she had seen me approach. Then I simply stepped up beside her, pointed to the restaurant across the street, and said, "Why the hell are we freezing here? Let's go over there and get some hot rum toddies." She let out a little laugh, slipped her arm through mine, and that was that. After three toddies, the barricades were gone, and we took a taxi to my apartment. When I marveled at her pleasure in the arms of a wicked man, the girl said she wanted to breed a child into herself. She kept my penis inside her for as long as possible, milking the last of the seed from it with her spasms. The world smelled of orgasms, and I laughed softly. Who knows, perhaps the seeds inside you are like a plowed furrow, the beginning of a new universe. Do you want to marry me? On the nightstand sat a Japanese statue of a woman on her knees in an embroidered kimono, her gaze veiled. The girl beside me sighed, sharply tugging the hair on my chest between her fingers. "I love you too." Then she said seriously, "You are like classical theater. Rich, handsome, a daddy of two, and a bachelor. Women must throw themselves at you." Then she kissed me possessively, her tongue moving slowly and deliberately across my skin, as if reading my true nature from its salty DNA. We talked of this and that. The words didn't matter, only the tenderness in our voices did. Everything between us was instantly and naturally understood at the deepest level, more familiar than with one's best friends. Nature recognizes compatible pairs from a single touch, and nothing is more moral than to follow its will. What did the age gap matter? Power dynamics and disparities in wealth hold no happiness in such matters. Touch is everything. There are no lies in making love, and both of us instantly knew the answers to the innermost questions. the kinds of questions that are never asked in casual flings. She looked at me with eyes full of love, and our game of chance had turned into the absolute truth. We didn't speak of our morning visit to the art museum. She burrowed deeper into my embrace, and from her pores puffed a fresh cloud of desire's chemistry, and I wanted her again. The flesh asks, and the flesh answers. Using the remote, I started a playlist on the stereo, and my favorite artist sang, "Go on and plant that apple tree, though the fire is already licking at your hair.